Turn your Bible with me, please, to the book of Genesis, chapter 25. Genesis, chapter 25. My opening and closing story today is taken from this book, Missionary Patriarch, the True Story of John Patton, who was a missionary to the New Hebrides Islands, islands of the South Sea, present-day Vanuatu, back in the 1800s. John Patton's life was greatly shaped and molded by his relationship with his father. And on page 25 of the book, he describes his parting as a young man from his father. "My dear father walked with me the first 6 miles of the way. His counsels and tears and heavenly conversation on that parting journey are fresh in my heart as if it had been but yesterday. And tears are on my cheeks as freely now as then whenever memory steals me away to that scene. For the last half mile or so, we walked on together in almost unbroken silence, my father, as was often his custom, carrying his hat in his hand. His lips kept moving in silent prayers for me, and his tears fell fast when our eyes met each other in looks for which all speech was vain. We halted on reaching the appointed parting place. He grasped my hand firmly for a minute in silence and then solemnly and affectionately said some of the most powerful words that John Patton would ever hear in his life. I want to speak to you this morning on the subject, four things children need from parents, or four gifts parents should give their children and never take them away. At birthdays and Christmas, parents are often thinking, what gift or gifts can I give to my child or to my children? I want you to listen carefully today and share with you several key gifts every parent ought to give to every one of his or her children. These are the most beautiful, most wonderful, and most lasting gifts that you could possibly give, and I promise you, they will be some of the most appreciated that you can ever give. In Genesis chapter 25, verse 19, "And these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife." And you find out, if you study this, in chapter 20 or chapter 26, you'll find out that these two were married 20 years then before they had children. "And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Paddan Aram, and the sister to Laban, the Syrian. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, 'If it be so, why am I thus?' And she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said unto her, 'Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger.' And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red, all over like a hairy garment. And they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau." Notice this, it's a key verse. "And Isaac loved Esau, his oldest son, because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob." You have the makings for disaster here because you have parents playing favorites with their children. "And Jacob sod pottage," it means he boiled some type of soup. "And Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, 'Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint.' Therefore was his name called Edom." It means red or earthy. "And Jacob said, 'Sell me this day thy birthright. And Esau said, behold, I'm at the point to die. And what profit shall this birthright do to me? And Jacob said, swear to me this day. And he sware unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Someone once wrote a poem that went something like this. Of the saddest words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these, it might have been. And that poem fits very well with the life of Esau. His life was one of the most tragic lives in Scripture. He was the firstborn of twins, with all the rights of the firstborn clearly his. The son of Isaac, the grandson of Abraham, good parentage, good lineage, good opportunity. And he probably wound up in hell. And if he did, or you do, Esau really couldn't blame anyone but himself. But there were some negative forces and damaging influences working in Esau's life. And there were some positive gifts his parents should have given him to help him overcome those negative things. The first thing that children need from their parents, and the first thing I point out to you that parents should give as a gift to their children, is the gift of a stable marriage. Why? Because a child needs both a father and a mother who are first a husband and a wife. A child shouldn't have to feel that he has to choose or be chosen by one or the other, like is happening so many times in courtrooms in our day. There's something horrifically unjust about a child being forced to choose whether he or she wants to live with dad or live with mom. It's unjust. Our court's supposed to be places of justice, and yet there is no way a court can truly be totally just in an area like that. It's unjust for them to decide it. How desperately America needs some judges who will be ministers of God for good and use the power and influence given them by God to say to parents before divorce, everyone has problems, work out your problems. How can you make sure that you are first a husband and then a father? How can you make sure that you are first a wife and then a mother? Well, it's by not becoming physically involved until after marriage. How can you do that? By not becoming emotionally involved until just before marriage. What you need to do is keep your heart for one other person with your parents' help and leadership and guidance and direction or some authority figures. Find the one that you believe is God's choice for your life, and after the decision is made, then you let the emotions come, and then after marriage, the physical relationship can take place. I read an article recently where a teenager was discussing her parents with somebody in the presence of several others, and a child listening in spoke up and said, "You have two parents? You have a father and a mother? I didn't know anybody had two parents." How sad that we're living in a day in America when there's so many children who don't have two parents. Now, please don't misunderstand me here. I'm not here to make anybody feel bad. That's not my goal in this message. If you're a single parent, you have your hands full enough, you sure don't need somebody kicking you, and that's not my goal. And I would say to you, you can raise a godly child as a single parent. It has been done many times. It has been done in this church. Two of the greatest preachers of the 20th century, Dr. J. Frank Norris and Dr. Jack Hiles, were raised by their mothers. In both cases, if I remember correctly, their fathers were both alcoholics. And those mothers pointed their sons to strong, godly, mature father images and encouraged them to relate to them and to be like them. A very wise man was asked a question by a single mother. She said, I am a single mom, divorced 8 years ago, and am seeking your advice in regard to my soon-to-be 18-year-old son. He seems to think he can do as he pleases and doesn't need to follow my instructions. Just this morning, he told his sister and me both to just shut up. Should I simply keep silent at these times when he's disrespectful or continue to remind him he's not honoring his mother that way? How can a single mother deal with a son like this? And the wise man wrote this as the answer. Many years ago, he said, I heard about three outstanding brothers who were raised by their mother. I asked them how their mother was able to be so successful without having a father in the home. And they gave me some valuable information every single mother should know and use. Their mother gathered them together after their father left and said, your father's no longer here. Now I must raise you. I want you to always remember one thing. I will only be your mother. I will never try to be your father. From now on, God is your father because he promised in Psalm 68:5 to be a father to the fatherless. So God from now on is your father. Those brothers went on to explain that throughout the day, their mother would talk about their heavenly father as if he were right there with them, and he was. Then whenever they got ready to go to some event, mother would say, now remember, God is your father, and he goes with you wherever you go. He sees everything you do. In the past, you could do things your father didn't know about, but not anymore. God is watching, and he will spank you if you do something that is wrong. Each brother said, our mother put the fear of God in us to the point we didn't dare misbehave. Proverbs 16:6 says, by the fear of the Lord, men depart from evil. And by lacking the proper reverence for God, this writer says, your son is not just dishonoring you, he is dishonoring God, and there are serious consequences for that. I'm talking about how a single parent can raise godly children. And I'm behind and supportive of single parents. But having said that, you know it is true that God's key plan is for a boy to have both a father and a mother, and the same for a girl. It is rooted in the created order itself. We did not evolve. God is the one who started all of this. He started with a man, and then he made from his side a woman. He brought her to the man. He actually performed, God himself performed the first wedding, and after they became husband and wife, then they became parents. Now, this is the reason that your marriage vow says, for better or for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, till death do you part. Why? So that your children would still have both a dad and a mom when things got worse. Because there are times when they could get worse. I was talking to some folks about marriage and told them that maybe we ought to reword the marriage vow so that they say, for better or worse, for richer or poorer, for sweeter or meaner, for fatter or leaner. Because once you're married, I mean, all kinds of things can happen in 20, 30, 40, 50 years of marriage. And children learn to love, not by being loved, but by watching love. Did you know that is one reason why on Sunday nights when we recognize anniversaries here, I have husbands and wives stand up, and I have the husband give his wife a little kiss on their anniversary so that children who will see that there are husbands and wives who love one another, because that's the way children learn to love, is by watching love. A writer African-American Washington Post columnist William Raspberry wrote this on July 25th of 2005. He said, father absence is the bane of the black community. predisposing his children, boys especially, but increasingly girls as well, to school failure, criminal behavior, and economic hardship, and to an intergenerational repetition of the grim cycle. Raspberry says the culprit is the decline of marriage. 2/3 of black babies in America are born out of wedlock. And one man who works with you says he often meets teenagers, quote, who have never seen a wedding. But the problem is not just in one particular racial group. The problem is everywhere. I was reading in a book, and the writer of the book said this: not far from where I pastor, there is a state prison. On any given day, there are between 4,000 and 6,000 inmates there. And according to the statistics, 78% of those men were raised without a father. And it is pointing out how children need a father and a mother who are in a stable marriage. And what happens when a father or mother just walk away? Then the people typically, the children will often get angry at God because of this absent or angry or abusive father. Because children form their understanding of God from their relationship with their dad. And if they don't see a model of faithfulness and love of God as dad shows this toward mom, then it sort of skews their understanding of who God is, and what kind of father he is, and they tend not to understand it. Terry Wilkins was raised in this church. His mom's sitting over there right now. His brother's here today. And I'm not sure when he wrote this poem, but I read part of this poem at his dad's funeral. He titled his poem, "What My Parents Did Not Teach Me." He said, "I was thinking about my parents and what they mean to me, the things they have taught and lived in order for me to be. Then there is the other hand, the things I never learned. What I never want to teach my family, within my heart these things churn. Dad, you came home every single night. I didn't have to worry if you and mom would fight. You didn't raise your voice to her, never did you lift your hand. I didn't worry about divorce or you moving to another land. I didn't have a stepmom or a stepdad in that case. It was my real mom baking cookies, my real dad taking me to the race. I never went to bed hungry, mom said that wasn't allowed. I never knew the smell of alcohol or even drugs, for crying out loud. Dad, you worked every day, and mom made sure we were clean, so I never learned about filthiness or what laziness did mean. There's so many things from my parents that I was never taught. For these things I never received, my gratitude can never be bought. I love you very much, Terry." I'm talking about how parents, children need the gift of a stable marriage between dad and mom, who are father and mother. That's a gift that you give to a child, that they will always appreciate it. And that marriage that you're in right now with those children in that home, you need to stay in that marriage and build that relationship and give the children the stability that they deserve and need. The second thing that children need from their parents is the gift of impartial parents who love each child with unconditional love. The gift of impartial parents who love each child with unconditional love without playing favorites. I'm talking about a love that accepts each child equally and does not play favorites with the children. You know, I don't know of any other passage in the Bible that deals with this as plainly as verse 27 and 28 that I read to you just a minute ago, talking about Esau and Jacob. The boys grew. Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field. Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. He liked to stay home. Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Let me pause right here and comment about how amazing are the differences between children. It really is amazing, isn't it? We immediately think how different a boy and a girl can be, and it's sad to say, but in our day you have to remind people that God does make boys and girls, all right? But I have news for you. If you have 10 boys, you have 10 different children. In this church today are adult children who are similar in some ways and yet are strikingly different. If I wanted to, I could take time and call some names of brothers who are adults and yet they're strikingly different. And here were two boys, Jacob and Esau. One very rough, the other very calm in nature. One a man and hunter of the field. The other a houseboy and a homebody. Some might say he was tied to his mama's apron strings. The differences between Jacob and Esau were God-given. What Isaac and Rebekah did with those differences was not God-ordained. Isaac loved Esau. He's proud of his boy, the athlete, the hunter. Rebekah loved Jacob. He was softer and kinder and a cook to boot. Who ever heard of such a thing in a boy? By the way, nothing wrong with that. Jacob didn't, my girls wish their dad would have learned to cook long ago. Their mom was in the hospital one time, and I walked in the kitchen, and I just threw it all in the pan and started cooking it. I mean, the eggs, the bread, the sausage, I just threw it all together and started cooking it. I thought, you know, that was the way to do it. Why? It's all going to wind up, you know, here anyway, so what does it matter? And they said later, they said, Mom, please, do something different. So it's nothing wrong, but for a boy to be able to cook, my girls wish their dad would have learned that. By the way, I still haven't learned that. And so I thank God not only for my wife, but for all you ladies who bring me cooked meals. Just throw that in right there. Jacob didn't need his daddy choosing Esau over him. And Esau didn't need Rebekah choosing Jacob over him. It is not right for a dad to spend all his time doting over his son and his daughter feel rejection. A lady who felt rejection from her father because she was a girl instead of a boy wrote these words in a nationwide magazine. One day, tiring of the heat and dust, Daddy announced, I'm going fishing. Though I barely knew what fishing was, I immediately cried my familiar, wait for me, and set out in hot pursuit. I soon discovered that fishing was mostly a lot of nothing as far as I could tell. Daddy ambled up and down the riverbank, casting and reeling. I stretched belly down on a warm rock. Finally, Daddy hauled in a fair-sized bass with a mouth that seemed to gasp help over and over again. Daddy secured his catch in a half-submerged basket, then wandered farther down the bank. I watched the bass with fascination from my rock as he bumped around inside the basket. By mid-morning, I had given him a name. I called him Sam. By the time lunch rolled around, I decided Sam had had enough of captivity. I opened the hinge door on the basket and wondered if the sense of exhilaration I had setting Sam free was similar to what Daddy felt reeling him in. Then I heard Dad say, Dina, Darlene, where's my bass? Daddy demanded. A flush crept up his neck like the mercury in a thermometer till his ears turned red. I frowned and pointed to the river. And Daddy knew me well enough to put two and two together already. He shot me a look and then his shoulders sagged in disappointment. And I knew right away what he was thinking. A son would have never done something so foolish. He didn't say it, but I was sure he wanted to. And that daughter felt rejection because she knew that her daddy really wanted a son, not a daughter. Rough and tough Esau needed the firmness of his daddy and the gracious sweetness of his mother. And softer Jacob needed both the soft touch of his mother and the rough as a cob approach of his daddy. Every child needs father and mother. I've seen times when my girls, when they were younger, would have been in a mess without the tender touch of their mother. And I've seen times when the tender touch needed to be set aside for the strong authority of their dad. And I would need to say, now, Mom, just let me take care of this, all right? Just let me do it. And that's what needed to happen. Why do we need impartial parents? Because the children need the acceptance of equal love. Parents, help each other out here. Help each other to recognize when you're showing favoritism. I remember several times as my children were coming up, my wife pulling me aside and saying, "Honey, I don't think you know it, but can I share with you? I think you're showing favoritism to Dawn over Andrea, or to Gina over Joanna, or who knows who." And I didn't see it at all. And she would begin to describe it to me, and I would say, "Thanks for showing me that. I didn't realize that. I don't mean..." She knew I didn't mean to. And so parents can help each other here. I'm talking about commitment to love your children equally. This love and commitment isn't what your child does for you. This is what you do for him or her, because it's what he or she needs you to do for him. The world's love isn't strong enough for some couples to love a baby girl when they're wanting a boy. So they just abort the girl and start again. Let me predict for you. When the surviving child gets old enough to find out and understand what happened, they'll also wonder what it will take for their parents to reject them. And they'll be thinking, "How am I really any different?" Now, let me picture this situation for you. You're a hunter. You're an avid hunter. You love to hunt. You have two boys. One likes to hunt, the other likes to play the piano. Which boy is most likely to wind up as your favorite? Which boy should you take to the woods? Let me answer, both of them. And mama shouldn't try to stop daddy when he says, "No, you're both going hunting with me." Because both of them need to be with daddy and need the acceptance of equal love. Children need unconditional, unquestioning, deeply committed love. Harold Holbert said, "Children need love, especially when they don't deserve it." I remember standing with some parents as their son was in an emergency room after he had done a really, really foolish thing, and overhearing the father as he said, "Son, I don't understand, but I love you. I don't understand, son, but I love you." And I was fighting back the tears as that father and mother were loving their son through a very difficult time in his life. I'm talking about the gift of impartial parents who love each child with unconditional love, and that's a love that accepts each child equally, and it is also a love that spends time with the child. Somebody said it like this: in bringing up children, spend on them half as much money and twice as much time. One of my favorite writers is Todd Wilson. Sends out a phenomenal email newsletter to fathers every week. And this is one of his newsletters from July of 2004. He said, "One evening I was enjoying the peace and quiet. A gentle breeze blew through the house, refreshing my bones within me. If only my wife would have brought me a tall, icy glass of freshly squeezed lemonade, everything would have been right with the world." Say amen, guys. Enter my 5-year-old son, Isaac. "Hey, Dad, remember you said we'd catch lightning bugs tonight. Is it time?" He smiled a sunny smile, the kind of annoying sunny that shines through the blinds in the morning and hits you right in the eyes. I held my breath and thought about pretending I was dead. He stood before me with the goofiest and most adorable grin on his face, waiting for my answer. Seconds ticked by, and I could hear the beat of my own heart as my mind scrambled for any kind of reasonable excuse. "Too wet? Nope, dry as a bone. Maybe tomorrow night? No, I said that last night. I don't want to risk getting the West Nile virus from a mosquito." "It'd take me an hour just to explain that to him." "Sure, we'll catch lightning bugs tonight," I heard myself say before I could stop it. "Good," he said cheerfully, and was off like a shot. An hour later, we were outside scooping up lightning bugs and putting them in a jar. The kids laughed and squealed in excitement during the hunt. Later that night, Ike and Abe fell asleep watching the lightning bug zoo that hung on their closet doorknob. Before I went to bed, I peered in on the sleeping boys in the jar with the glowing bugs. And remember the jars of lightning bugs that I took to bed as a kid? How many of y'all did that? I did. I was just wondering if I was the only one ever did that. You see, we did something. I remember laying in bed with my lightning bugs in the jar and pulling the covers over the top and getting in total darkness to see how much light they put out. Anybody else do that? Good, 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 good. All right. So I peered in, saw the... You see, we did something eternal that night, something that my children will never forget. They may not remember the lightning bug part, but they'll remember the "they did it with Dad" part. And to think it all took only 10 minutes and I almost said no. How many other things have I missed that would have only taken a few minutes or a few hours? I'd rather not think about it, but I better. We play for keeps, us dads. So if you go on a lightning bug safari lately, tonight might be perfect. Maybe there's something else the kids have been asking you to do. Maybe tonight would be perfect for that as well. I'm talking about spending time with your children. Somebody said love is spelled T-I-M-E. And then this is not only a love that accepts each child equally and spends time with each child. It is a love, get this, that studies each child. Could I suggest to you, if you've never done it, study your children. A pastor whose son set their house on fire and almost burned it to the ground was asked the question, "Can you tell me something that'll help me with my children?" And the pastor gave the answer, "Yes, spend a lot of time studying your children. Watch them, know their tendencies, get into their world." He continued, "Here's the problem. By the time we get our children figured out, they're too old to change." Proverbs 22:6, "Train up a child in the way he should go." I remember a night years ago when my wife and I and all four of our children were at home, and we set aside a night and went out to eat and just sat for an hour and a half with pencil and paper in front of us and talked about our children and what their tendencies were, what their strengths were, what their weaknesses were, and what we needed to do to help them and how we could serve them. Parents, study your child from the time they are little. Watch their personalities. Notice their strengths and weaknesses. Talk to others about what they see in your children. I remember talking to Brother Brian about what he saw in my children. I remember talking to some of you about what do you see in my children. How can I help them? Make a prayer list for each child based on what you see in your child. One of the most exciting things you'll ever do as a parent is pray specifically for your child in some specific area and see God answer that prayer. Just recently, I was reading through my prayer list and not just reading, but trying to be sincere and praying for my children. And as I got to one of my children, I paused and I said, "Oh God, you have answered that prayer. I've been praying that for months, and you clearly have answered that prayer. Thank you for helping my daughter in that area." Ask your child, "What can I pray for you about?" I've had mothers tell me they learn things about their children's personalities before the child was even born. Is that possible? Well, look at Jacob and Esau fighting in their mother's womb. How about John the Baptist leaping in his mother's womb for joy? I want to tell you, you will not start too early training your children or studying your children. Swedish scientist Dr. E. Wedenberg said, "In the 24th week of intrauterine life, the fetus is listening all the time." There are babies here today whose personalities already, at a few days old, I suppose if we had asked these two sets of parents that were up here with brand new babies a little while ago, they would tell us they're already seeing things in their children's personalities. Follow this thought right here, would you? Every child is born with a sin nature and a tendency to sin. Every child is also born with a tendency to lean toward some sin or sins more than others because of their personalities. That doesn't mean they're born that particular way. It means everybody has a sin nature that can go any direction. Esau had more of a tendency toward violent sin. Red-haired, hot-tempered, outdoorsman-type fellow, that's what he was. And when his brother did him wrong, he was ready to kill him. As far as we know, Jacob never considered doing such a thing to Esau ever. Esau was more likely to fight. Jacob was more likely to whine. Esau was more likely to cuss. Jacob was more likely to deceive. Esau was more likely to be immoral. Jacob was more likely to be a cheater. One child is more likely to get into wild wickedness. Another child more likely to get into rebelliousness. Another child more likely to be jealous. Another child more likely to be lazy. Another child more likely to disobey. Another child more likely to obey. Another child more likely to get offended. Children tend to lean towards some certain sin or type of sin. And you have to notice that and study that and train that child in the way he should go. That means you firmly refuse to let that child get by with that, whatever it might be. This unconditional love is also, and I'm already into that, a love that trains the child. Many of you are familiar with Proverbs 22:6. You could say it with me, would you please? Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, training is more than just teaching. Training is having the child do what you're telling him to do. Training is going over and over and over and practicing something over and over until what you're learning becomes as much a part of life as if you had been born with it. I asked a child, oh, I guess he's 12 years old or so. Last night I said, did you do that? He said, yeah. I just asked him again, did you do that? Yeah. I just asked him again, did you do that? He said, oh, yes, sir. Now, what was I doing? I was training him. I was saying, sorry, I'm not going to let you get by because you need to learn respectfulness. You know, it's sad but true. A lot of people spend more time training their dogs than they will their daughters or their sons. I read about a circus monkey, a chimp, in 1945. Some people went to the house where the circus people had this chimp, and as they walked in, the chimp held the door. When they sat down, the chimp took their jacket and hung it up. They watched in amazement as the chimp set the table, sat at the table, and with good manners ate his food with the rest of them around the table. That'd be weird, wouldn't it? When they got done eating, the chimp cleared the table, washed the dishes, dried them, and put them away. The person who witnessed that wrote an advice columnist and said, I have never forgotten. It's one of the most phenomenal things. Now, how did a chimpanzee do that? That chimp was trained to do that. Somebody went over and over and over until the chimp learned to do it. Did you know you can do the same thing with virtually any child? You know, the biggest problem with hyperactive children is not that they all have ADHD. The biggest problem is somebody needs to sit down and train. The solution is not Ritalin for every child on the planet. The solution is just old-fashioned. No, you're going to do this. Only one other time is the word trained used in the Bible like it is used in Proverbs 22:6. Would you notice this? I'd never seen this before. It's about a few pages in Genesis 14:14. Only one other time is this word train up a child. And only one other time, the English word and the Hebrew word are both similar in that, in their meaning. Look at Genesis 14:14. And when Abram heard that his brother, referring to Lot, was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. And the Hebrew word there for trained servants means trained, instructed, tried, experienced. These were servants who were soldiers. You want to know, I can't believe what is in this passage. Do you know what God is showing us here by putting these two words, Proverbs 22:6 and Genesis 14:14, is the only two times in the Bible that this word, the Hebrew word is similar, the English word is identical. You know what God is doing? God is telling us, you want to train children, you train them just like the military trains soldiers. Take out the roughness, take out the screaming, take out the harshness. But soldiers, how are they trained? They tell them how to do it. They show them how to do it. They help them do it. Then they have them do it over and over and over again till they can do it in their sleep. I've had soldiers who have been trained tell me, we were taught to take apart our rifle and put it back together, and take it apart and put it back together, and take it apart and put it back together until we could do it in total darkness. What is that? That is training. That's what you do with a child. Whatever you want the child to do, you tell them how to do it. You show them how to do it. You do it with them, and then you have them do it over and over and over until they can do it in the dark in their sleep, till they're dreaming it. By the way, Abraham's servants, trained servants, trained soldiers, went after Lot and rescued him and everybody with him and won the battle. And the message is, well-trained children are far more likely to win the battle against the world, the flesh, and the devil as well. There are folks sitting here this morning with habits in your life that have been difficult for you to break, or you are trying to break them right now. And do you know what you wish? You wish somebody back yonder had set you down and made you do right. Had set you down and said, you will do this, I love you, and with a firm, gentle hand would have done it while it could still be done. You see, you can reach a point where a child's so old, it's hard to train him. I've got a tree in my yard that I just got tired of it looking like this. Watch my hand here, it looks like this. And about a year or so ago, my son-in-law came over to the house and I took a bigger tree as a post, and I put it right next to that tree, and I put C-clamps on there, and I am in the process of straightening that tree. But you know what I found out? I will never get that tree totally straight. It will not be possible. I waited too long to work on the tree. Do you know you can take a sapling and you can bend that sapling any direction you want to? You can reach a point where that tree will no longer straighten up. Now, I am getting it a lot straighter than it was because I'm diligent. I'm staying after it. I work on it all the time. And that tree's going to look pretty good when I get done. But it'd have been better if I'd have started on it much sooner. A lady who trained her children well wrote this. Somebody sent it to me in an email. She said, first of all, as far as training them when they're little, when my children were first learning to talk around two-ish, I'd go in their room in the morning. They were still in cribs, and I would say, good morning. Can you tell God good morning? Let's tell God thank you for this beautiful day. Tell God how much you love him, and I would do it over and over. Just something very simple. And yet my whole point was that they would get used to talking to God first thing in the morning at age two. Now when they got to be three, we moved them to toddler bed. When I moved my daughter into her bed, along with that came the rule she was not to get out of her bed without permission unless there was an emergency. And we told her this. And this was not done without resistance, I might add. My daughter is very strong-willed, so I knew she would test the waters. That's where my husband and I had to be very consistent with her and follow through on our discipline for her disobedience. Not easy at first, but it didn't take long at all for her to know what we meant what we said. In addition to not coming out at night, this means she also had to ask permission to come out of her room in the morning. Now, our goal here was not to run a military school. Laugh out loud, she writes. Rather, we saw this as groundwork for further disciplines we wanted her to attain in life. One major one being the establishment of a quiet time with God every morning. And then she tells how, on the next page, she tells how she had a monitor in the child's room and taught the child at 3 years of age to talk and pray to God every morning. And she said, I've got some of it taped, and it's some of the sweetest things I've ever heard in my life. There are things you have to train a child to do. You have to train a child to tie shoelaces. You don't scream at them. You just do what I said a couple of minutes ago. You tell them how to do it. You show them how to do it. You help them do it. And you have them do it over and over till they can do it in their sleep. I remember as a little boy, one of my older brothers teaching me how to tie my shoes. I could take you to the spot in the house where he taught me. I was so tired of somebody having to tie my shoes for me, and I wanted to learn how, and he was patient enough to teach me. You have to train somebody to do that. You have to train them how to button a shirt so it's not crooked when you get all the way down. You have to train them how to do their hair. You have to train them to listen, to pay attention. Did you know you can train a child to sit up and listen in church? You know how? You do it in family devotions. You do it at home with your family devotions, and you extend the time each time, and you train them to sit still and listen quietly, and it won't be long till you can. You have to train a child to come when you call them immediately, to take something and put it where you want it. You have to train them to look you in the eyes. Parents, if your children are not looking you in the eyes when you're talking to them, you are going to have problems with your children at some point in time. You have to train them to not touch something you don't want them to touch. You have to train them to move immediately when spoken to stop walking immediately when told to stop talking immediately when told to smile when he doesn't feel like it, to sit still, to wash dishes, to put them away, to vacuum a floor, to sweep a floor, to mop a floor, to wax the floor, to mow a lawn. I could go on and on. By the way, follow the principle of Acts chapter 6. Verses 1 through 7 in relation to your children. In Acts chapter 6, the apostles let the younger Christians, I believe they were this was the appointment of deacons, do everything they could, and then the apostles did these other things. So let the younger ones in the family do everything they can, train them to do everything they can. Listen, you'll create bitterness in children if you have older children always picking up after younger children. If a child can take it out, he can be taught to put it away. Don't put it away for him. Don't let somebody else put it away for him. Train him that if he takes it out, he must put it away. So let the younger children in the family do everything they can and reserve more difficult things for those older, and your whole home will run much more smoothly. I'm talking about children need parents who love each child with unconditional love, that accepts each child equally, loves to spend time with the child, a love that studies the child, a love that trains the child, and get this, oh, this is so important, a love that enjoys the child. You ought to enjoy your children. Good night. They're made by God to be enjoyed. They're cute. They're made by God to be enjoyed. Revelation 4:11 tells why God created man. For thy pleasure they are and were created. God, for his pleasure, he won't enjoy man. Why? I had somebody ask me a couple of weeks ago, why did God make man to start with? There's the answer. He won't enjoy being with him. Did you know you ought to feel that with your children? Psalm 149:4 says, for the Lord taketh pleasure in his people. Somebody put it like this. You can't be a better parent than you are a smiler. Only a smile gives you power with children. Like a sunflower turns its face to the sun, so a child will turn his face to anyone who will smile at him. The third gift that you need to give your children is the gift of praise and encouragement. That motivates a child to have a sense of value and worth. You know what? You talk highly about things you feel are worth a lot. Your car, your gun, your house, your business. If it's worth a lot to you, you talk highly about it. Could I ask you, do you talk highly about your children? Could I warn you of something right here? Don't compare your children. Why can't you be more like your brother? Why aren't you beautiful like your sister? What a devastating thing to say to a child. The Bible says that we're to enter into God's presence with thanksgiving and praise. Can I suggest to you, you ought to enter into the presence of your children with thanksgiving and praise. How critical and discouraging we can be with our words. The Bible says death and life are in the power of the tongue. Give life to your mate's dreams. Give life to your children's dreams and aspirations with your words. Make sure they are words of praise and encouragement. Proverbs 31:26 talks about the virtuous woman, says, in her tongue is the law of kindness. Always be kind. Make it a law at your house that you never break for any reason. You are going to be kind. Now you got to praise the right things. Isaac and Rebekah were keying in on their children's weaknesses and making them worse. Jacob was already deceitful, and his mother assisted him in his deceitfulness. Children don't need any encouragement in the direction of wrong. They can do wrong, hear me, without anybody's help. Children need to be encouraged to do right. Think about this. What did Daddy Isaac admire in his son Esau? His talent, his skill at hunting, his physical abilities. Dad, praise your son more for having the character read his Bible and pray every day than you do for him scoring a few points in a basketball game or knocking a home run in a softball game. Pardon the analogy here, but what do you praise more in a dog, looks or obedience? What should you praise more in your daughter, looks or obedience? It is still very true, and I don't like the comparison, but it communicates. Dedication is more important than talent. Praise discipline, not IQ. Praise responsibility, not self-indulgent. Praise character, not ability. Praise self-control, not good looks. It's 1,000 times more important for a guy to sweep his room than for him to be able to sweep a girl off her feet. Teddy Roosevelt, President of the United States, was also a phenomenal father. And he was even more concerned about his children's moral development. In a letter to Kerman in which he praised his son's interest in playing football, he wrote this. Listen, it's powerful. I'd rather have a boy of mine stand high in his studies than high in athletics. But I would a great deal rather have him show true manliness of character than show either intellectual or physical prowess. What do children need from parents? They need the gift of a stable marriage between dad and mom that gives them a father and a mother. They need impartial parents who love each child with unconditional love. They need the gift of praise. And last, they need the gift of a genuine spiritual example. They need the gift. They need parents to give them a spiritual, not just take them to church, but set a spiritual example for them. Listen to Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 9. Only take heed to thyself and keep thy soul diligently, lest thou forget the things which thine eyes have seen, and lest they depart from thy heart all the days of thy life. But teach them thy sons and thy sons' sons. He says, you make sure that you keep yourself right with God, and then remember what God had done for you, and then teach that to your children. Can I tell you? If you say one thing, then do something else. A child is far more likely to follow what you do than what you say. A genuine spiritual example, Hebrews chapter 12, I won't turn there, calls Esau a profane person. And that is probably the key word that describes this man Esau. It tells us that Esau was totally uninterested in spiritual things. There was nothing sacred or holy in his life. He was completely absorbed in possessions and pleasures and the present. And the word profane is an interesting and unusual word. It doesn't mean vile and filthy and wicked. It comes from the word profanum that meant outside the temple. And the picture was of a man who came in contact with a God, with God, but did not want God. The picture of Esau is of a man who came to the door of the temple and looked inside and stood and watched the worship of God and said, "Not for me." Some people might think a profane person like Esau would be a super terrible, wicked sinner. But he was actually a congenial fellow, a good hunter, a man who loved his father, would have probably made a good neighbor, but he had zero interest in the things of God. There could be people like that here this morning. If so, don't stop listening before you hear the end of Esau, because Hebrews tells us that afterward, Esau sought a place of repentance with bitter tears. The profane person never weeps now, but they often weep later. The profane person is seldom touched now, but they may want to be touched later. But later could be too late. Is God speaking to your heart today? You are an example for somebody else. I began with John Patton walking, leaving home, and his father walking along with him. And the father looked at him and said, "God bless you, my son." After they'd walked 6 miles together, "Your father's God prosper you and keep you from all evil." Unable to say more, his lips kept moving in silent prayer. In tears we embraced and parted. I ran off as fast as I could. And when about to turn a corner in the road where he could lose sight of me, I looked back and saw my father still standing with head uncovered where I had left him, gazing after me, waving my hat in adieu. I was round the corner and out of sight in an instant. But my heart was too full and sore to carry me further, so I darted to the side of the road and wept for a while. Then rising cautiously, I climbed the dike to see if Father yet stood where I had left him. And just at that moment, I caught a glimpse of him climbing the dike looking for me. He didn't see me, and after he had gazed eagerly in my direction for a while, he got down, set his face toward home, and began to return, his head still uncovered, his heart still rising in prayer for me. I watched through blinding tears till his form faded from my gaze, and then hastening on my way, vowed deeply by the help of God to live and act so as never to grieve or dishonor such a father and mother as he had given me. The appearance of my father when we parted, his advice, prayers, and tears, the road, the dike, the climbing up on it, and then walking away head uncovered, have often through my life risen vividly before my mind. And do so now while I'm writing as if it had been just an hour ago. He was an old man when he wrote this book. In my earlier years, particularly when exposed to temptations, Father's parting form rose before me as that of a guardian angel. It is no Phariseeism, but deep gratitude which makes me here testify that the memory of that scene not only helped by God's grace to keep me pure from prevailing sins, but also stimulated me in all my studies that I might not fall short of His hopes, and in all my Christian duties that I might faithfully follow His shining example. The impact of a father and a mother is a great, great impact on a child. Parents here, children need these things from you. Above all, they need a real, genuine, spiritual example. Would you bow with me, please?